This is The State of Things. I'm Phoebe Judge. The Argentinian Marxist revolutionary Che Guevara has become something of a symbol for radical social change. He's so much a symbol that you might have seen his image on a T-shirt or a bumper sticker suggesting something vague about resistance and guerrilla warfare. But who was the man behind the icon? A feminist poet has written a new book representing Guevara in his own historical context, one that recognizes both the power and the limitations of the icon. Margaret Randall's book is Che on My Mind, and she'll launch it tonight at 7 at the Internationalist Bookstore and Community Center in Chapel Hill. She joins us in the studio. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you, Phoebe.
So Guevara as a symbol is more powerful than a man could ever be. How does your book address that?
Well, my book tries to get into the backstory. I guess that's the best way to put it. I'm a poet. It doesn't pretend to be a biography of Che Guevara. There are many of those, good and bad and in between. It's really a feminist poet's book about the man, about his era, about his dream. And from my point of view, about the things, the lasting legacy, as well as some of the things that he stood for, which may not be so useful today.
What was the impetus for you to write Che on My Mind?
I lived in Cuba for 11 years in the 1970s. I never knew Che Guevara. He had been killed just shortly before I got there. But my kids went to school with his kids. I knew his wife. I, of course, was very much affected by his aura, as were all of us who were interested in making social change at that time in Latin America. And so he was a fascinating figure who was sort of a presence. And I've always thought about him. He sort of kind of festered, if you will, in my consciousness all these years. And it finally just seemed time to do this.
What were the layers of meaning that you found, I mean, all throughout this guy's life, but just in the name Che?
Well, that's an interesting question, because Che means really dude, buddy, guy. You know, it's an Argentinian way of referring to male, especially young males. And but in the word Che, C-H-E, of course, if you take the C away, it's just the H and the E. So it's this very sort of male pronoun. And in Argentina, anybody could be called Che, but Che became the Che. And so in a way, in my sense of things, it was the ordinary becoming extraordinary in the figure of this man.
Why was it important to you as a feminist to engage with such a difficult figure of masculinity? What did you set out to discover?
You know, I never set out to discover anything in particular, because I think that leads you down the wrong road. I set out to discover whatever it was his life was going to give me, and I found some surprises.
Will you read for us?
I'll read from the very first couple of pages of the book, and I hope that this will set the tone. I start out by saying, Ernesto Che Guevara occupies a place in our emotional iconography unsurpassed by anyone, with the exception of Buddha, Mohammed, Marx, Mary, or Jesus of Nazareth. Still contemporary, because his death at 39 isn't yet half a century behind us, he's a figure revered in equal measure by both convinced revolutionaries and apolitical youth at the farthest reaches of our planet. All see in him a symbol of nonconformity, of resistance. And like so many humans we've embalmed in myth, scholars and those who don't think past the image, devotees and detractors alike tend to ignore a more nuanced view of the man. I'm old enough to remember the world in which he lived, and I was part of that world, and it remains a part of me. So this won't be a political or economic treatise, except where that sort of analysis strengthens my observations. It's a poet's reminiscence of an era and of the figure that best exemplifies that era. These musings may also help us rethink revolutionary change and how a reexamination of history may point to a more productive way of achieving that change. This is the story of how Che haunts me. I call it Che on My Mind, mimicking the old Hoagy Carmichael and Stuart Gurrell tune, Georgia on My Mind. It's that spirit and wandering rhythm I wish to evoke, moving in one direction and then another, exploring the texture, or that giving free rein to memory and to a consciousness Che helped to shape.
You specify that this book is a poet's reminiscence. How has being a poet shaped your interpretations of Guevara?
Being a poet really is my deepest identity. So it's where I go. I go to my poetness, if you will, to see anything, to listen to anything, to think about anything, to feel about anything. So in writing a book like this about someone who lived during my lifetime, who has been so mythologized, is so hated by some and so beloved by others, it was sort of, being a poet seemed to me to be my roadmap, just a way to help me get into thinking and writing about the man.
Can you imagine yourself having a conversation with Guevara, with him? How do you think it might have gone?
Oh, I think it would have been great fun. I would have loved to have had a conversation with him. He was a profoundly intellectual man. He was a doctor, of course, but he also read in anthropology and history and economics. He was a great connoisseur of art. He loved poetry. People said that in his last campaign, when he was emaciated and close to death and being, you know, sought on all sides by the Bolivian army and the CIA, he still carried books of poetry in his knapsack, and to the exclusion of food even, bullets. So I think we would have had a wonderful conversation.
In the book, you admire Che for his transnational reach. What about that? What about that intrigues you?
What really intrigues me about Che was that he was determined to see the liberation of all peoples. The way he went about that is something that I find fault with in certain ways. But his internationalism for me was crossing borders when he really didn't have to. He had a very important job in the Cuban Revolution. He had fought in the Cuban Revolution. He was important in the new state in Cuba. And yet he left again because he was intent on helping liberating peoples from poverty and misery. And that's what really attracts him to me.
You yourself have spent much of your life in countries other than the United States, where you were born. Do you relate to him in that way?
Perhaps. That's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about it, but perhaps that's true.
And after living in Mexico for many years, you were refused United States citizenship, even though you were born in this country, because of some of your writings. What was that experience like?
It wasn't fun. It was really after I lived in Mexico and Cuba and Nicaragua that I came back to this country after 23 years in 1984. And opinions expressed in some of my books did not agree with opinions put out by the U.S. government at the time. And so, but I think they were really more upset about the fact that I had lived in these countries, such as Cuba and Nicaragua, which were certainly not in favor here at the time. And so they decided to go after me through McCarran-Walter, the 1952 Immigration and Naturalization Act, under the Ideological Exclusion Clause. And it was a rough 5 years. I lost at one instance after another, and then I finally won with the help of many, many good people.
Will you read a poem for us?
Yes, I'd love to. Like many of us, I think one of my big concerns these days is the environment, is climate change. And so this is a poem that speaks to that. It's from a forthcoming book. The poem is called Cool Compresses and Non-Binding Law. Now the patient's fever spikes at dawn as well as late afternoon. Cool compresses and non-binding law do nothing to bring it down. Glaciers melt, filling valleys with oceans of salt. The patient must sleep upright, her lungs no longer expand or retract in harmony. Teeth chattering like insulted bone, she sweats toxic waste and fracking's poison, vomits the bile of mutilated seeds. The fire on her brow swallows wilderness, great cities and small towns. Branches crackle like charred veins. Science fiction, a pale portrait of her agony. Preventative medicine was the only way to avoid this fatal turn. We're years past that now. Breathtaking no longer means beautiful. No morphine, hospice, or final ritual. This illness increases dangerous levels of testosterone. The patient's fever rises off the charts. Her death, a matter of time. Her preventable disease reaches every orphan child, every pristine landscape buried in ash, hurricane or earthquake, off the Richter scale. A pandemic of rapes and murders opens like sores on her once fertile body. Desperate migrations push through permanently clogged arteries. The patient's echoing warnings may be observed or not by some future species when oblivious time returns.
What inspired that poem?
What inspired that poem is my fear that it may be too late for what's happening to our earth and our absurd, to my way of thinking, inactivity, our failure to try to turn this around.
You've been a poet for a long time now. Are there things that you're interested in writing about now that you haven't always been or you're finding yourself drawn to?
Oh, absolutely. I think we just keep on changing in our lives. And, you know, at 77, I'm certainly interested in things, compelled by things that weren't even on my radar screen at 27 or 37. So, you know, I became a mother, I became a grandmother. So everything, yes, everything that I write about today, many of those things I would never have written about before.
You're particularly interested with the environment and climate change. Your poem preface relates to that, again, specifically. Will you read it for us?
Yes, I will. Thank you. 1936. I hurried, as always, but was late. 8 centuries or 10,000 years, my small story fixed to my back. Food came weighed and wrapped, shelter engorged as surplus. My own, was a mantra I could sing in any season. I could be who I was and also anyone else. Late, and also much too early, I came to justice before its time. Unprepared to receive me, its rough grasp hurt my hand, embedded its promises in my flesh. Juggling gender, I was early and also late. Juggling children, service, my explosion of words on stone, parchment, or floating cybercloud. Only poetry and love met me where we laughed. After so many false starts, they came in whole and sure before the finish line. My hand fit the ancient print, a radius of living settled on my shoulders. I am lunar standstill now, calendar of hope. It is 2014, and I discover I am perfectly on time. Soon I will disappear, together with all my kind, and the earth, with its synchronized clock, will wake some blue-green morning, its rhythm safe for a while.
It's rather optimistic.
Yes, I am an optimist at heart, despite it all.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Margaret Randall is a poet and the author of Che on My Mind. She will read at the Internationalist Bookstore and Community Center in Chapel Hill tonight at 7 p.m. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our show or want to hear archived editions of past programs, go to our website at stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Phoebe Judge.